Marcos, would you be kind enough to do the Pledge of Allegiance for us?
Absolutely. Everybody, please place your right hand over your heart and ready to get a pledge of allegiance
to the flag
of the United States of America, to the Republic,
which stands one nation, indivisible,
liberty and justice for all. All right, thank you for that. We have a council roll call.
Vladimir Anderson. Eric Duane.
Present.
Alexis Federico.
Present.
Alexander Gonzalez. Alex Maslin.
Present.
Robert McDonald.
I'm here.
Mario Munoz. Marcos Villa.
Present.
Stephanie Wade.
Present.
And we have quorum, Chair.
All right, thank you. I got a message from Vladimir Anderson that for whatever reason he's unable to join. So at least he got a message in for us. We'll go ahead and move on to item 4, public comment. At this time, do we have any members in the that have joined us today that are?
We did not receive any public comment requests via email, and we do have a couple of attendees. Members of the public. If there are members of the public present this morning that or this afternoon that would like to speak during the public comment, please use the hand raise icon or press *9 if you are calling in, and I will unmute you. Seeing no hands, Chair.
All right, I'm gonna, apologies, I'm trying to get this info to Vladimir as quickly as possible. It's not working too well. All right, action item. So we've been doing this just about every month that we've been working in a Zoom mode. So if we could get this, this is AB 361. Turn it over to Elena, if you could explain it.
let me just remind myself again about this one.
I can jump in if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm just tracking on that update.
He probably doesn't know the AB number, but this is regarding the 30-day vote that all councils need to take in order to continue conducting their meetings virtually. So I believe, Eric, if you could actually read verbatim the language on the action item from the agenda, and then we'll have to take a roll call vote.
You got it. Recommendation is to continue virtual meetings due to the proclaimed state of the emergency arising from COVID-19. Meeting in person presents imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees, and the emergency continues to directly impact the ability of members to meet safely in person. So that is the recommendation. Do I have a motion?
I'll move.
All right. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Discussion? All right. Let's get a vote.
Vladimir Anderson.
Affirmative. Aye.
Eric Duane.
Aye.
Alexis Federico.
Aye.
Alexander Gonzalez. Alex Maslin.
Aye.
Robert McDonald.
Yes.
Mario Munoz. Marcos Villa.
Aye.
And Stephanie Wade.
Aye.
And that is majority, Chair.
All right, fantastic. We can move into item 6, our presentations. We have, I see John Cleveland is here and Nicole Swain. So OC bylaws and Brown Act refresher is gonna be John Cleveland. John, are you here? There he is. And we also have Nicole Swain. So John is a senior deputy counsel for Orange or County of Orange, and Nicole comes to us. She's a special projects manager from OC Community Resources. You have the floor.
Great. Well, thank you for that introduction. And good afternoon, everyone. Happy Wednesday. I'd like to start by thanking the Orange County Veterans Advisory Council for inviting John and I here today to review these important topics with you all. I'd also like to share a little history behind the why for the conception of this training presentation. Our OC Community Resources leadership team values our council members and appreciates their services to our department, this county, and our community. And they sought out a way to offer our new and even experienced participants a training on the most inquired about topics. County Council graciously collaborated with us on this presentation to provide all of you an in-depth review of these areas of interest. Of course, we're always looking to enhance training opportunities that are offered, so please feel free to offer suggestions or ask questions related to our training at the end of the presentation. Hope this works. Yes. Okay, good. Sorry, guys. I'm used to Teams, so I'm also familiarizing myself with Zoom. We are always looking to enhance our training opportunities, like I said, so at the end, you can feel free to share, but I'm going to go ahead and skip introductions because the chair so already introduced us, but John, are you here? I have like a little screen because I have the presentation up.
I'm here, ready.
Okay, great. I can't see you, so. Great. So the topics we'll be reviewing today include the Brown Act, AB 361, the County Executive Office policy, as well as their new bylaws template, your specific bylaws and some just overall overview of them. And then obviously we will have an opportunity for questions related to our training materials at the end. Okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and hand it over to John now to review the important history, key concepts, and legality of the Brown Act.
Thank you, Nicole and everyone. We're gonna do a quick overview of the Brown Act. As you know, the Brown Act requires open and public meetings. Your OCVAC is subject to the Brown Act. The basic rule of the Brown Act is that meetings of legislative bodies must be open and public, and the actions of committees like yours must be taken openly, and deliberations must be taken openly. The purpose is to facilitate public participation and to enable people to be informed about the operation of government so that they can curb the potential misuse of the democratic process. Let's go to the next slide. Are you able to go to the next slide?
I did. Are you not seeing it?
I see it now. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe there's a delay.
So there's a couple of key concepts when you consider whether the Brown Act applies to a board, committee, or council, and they relate to the definitions of a legislative body and local agency. A legislative body is the governing board of a local agency or any local board created by statute, and also includes any commission, committee, board, or other body created by formal action of a legislative body. A local agency includes the county, or any board, commission, or agency thereof.
John, you still don't see it?
Yeah, a little delay there.
Okay,
I see it now. So there's an exception to what constitutes a legislative body. This exception is known as the ad hoc committee exception. When you have an ad hoc advisory committee composed solely of members of the legislative body that are less than a quorum of the legislative body, that ad hoc committee can be not subject to the Brown Act. The requirement, though, or the exception to the exception, is that the ad hoc committee must be a very time and purpose limited entity. So standing committees are, even if composed of less than a quorum of the legislative body, are still subject to the open meeting requirements of the Brown Act. go to the next slide.
That's a long delay.
Yeah.
I turned it a while back.
All right. So the Brown Act applies to meetings of legislative bodies. What is a meeting? A meeting is a congregation of a majority of the members of the legislative body at the same time and location to discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. Let's go to the next slide. Serial meetings are prohibited. So this is gets into what is a meeting. You can inadvertently create a meeting through serial communications. You can also inadvertently create a meeting through a hub and spoke scenario. So everyone should be on guard to protect against having a meeting through a series of communications that directly or indirectly through intermediaries results in a discussion or deliberation or taking of action on any items of business that are within the subject matter jurisdiction of your local legislative body. However, one-way briefings are permitted. The prohibition on serial meetings shall not be construed as preventing any employee or official of the local agency from engaging in separate conversations or communications with members of the legislative body in order to answer questions or provide information regarding a matter that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the local agency, provided that the positions or opinions or the potential actions of the legislative members are not communicated in serial fashion to other members of the legislative body. Let's go on to the next slide. So there's a few other exceptions to the definition of meeting. There's an exception for the individual contacts or conversations between a member of a legislative body and any other person. We just talked about that a bit. There's also an exception for attendance at conferences open to the public or at community meetings, attendance at an open and notice meeting of another local agency, attending purely social or ceremonial occasions. There's also an exception for attending an open and notice standing committee meeting, provided that members attend only as observers. If you ever think that you may need to take advantage of one of these exceptions, please contact OCCR staff. We can loop in county council and we can examine the details and requirements for each of the exceptions. So now let's look at regular meetings and the agenda and notice requirements for each. Each legislative body shall provide by notice the time and place for holding a regular meeting. And the agenda must state the items to be acted upon at that meeting. Notice must go out at least 72 hours before a regular meeting, and the agenda must be posted at a location freely accessible to members of the public and on the agency's primary website. Except as otherwise provided by law, no action or discussion shall be undertaken on any item not appearing on a posted agenda. And this is really a core concept of the Brown Act. You can't discuss or take action on anything that hasn't been properly agendized. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, there's also special meetings provided for in the Brown Act, and the special meeting may be called at any time by the presiding officer of the legislative body or by majority of the members of the legislative body by posting a notice and delivering that notice to each member of the local legislative body and to each member of the media requesting such a notice. The special meeting requirements provide for a short notice period of only 24 hours. And the call and notice will specify the time and place of the special meeting and the business to be transacted or discussed. No other business shall be considered at these special meetings by the legislative body except for what has been agendized. Let's go to the special. Okay, there's also emergency meetings. This probably doesn't come up often, but an emergency is defined as a work stoppage, crippling activity, or other activity that severely impairs the public health, safety, or both. And in the case of emergency meetings, a legislative body may hold an emergency meeting without complying with the 24-hour special meeting notice and posting requirements, as long as telephonic notice is provided. Okay, there's the Brown Act requires the public participation at meetings or regular and special meetings. Members of the public have a right to address the legislative body on any item appearing on the agenda before or at the time the legislative body considers the item. The Brown Act generally requires all meetings be open to public. And each regular meeting shall also provide an opportunity for members of the public to address the legislative body on any item of interest to the public within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body. The Brown Act generally requires all votes to be reported out in public, and there's no process allowed for taking secret votes or presenting secret ballots that aren't publicly known. Okay, this is an important question that comes up quite frequently. When can an item not appearing on the posted agenda be discussed or acted upon? The general rule is no official action can be taken on non-agendized matters, but members of a legislative body or its staff may briefly respond to statements made or questions posed by persons exercising their public testimony rights. On their own initiative or in response to questions posed by the public, a member of a legislative body or its staff may ask a question, ask for clarification, make a brief announcement, or make a brief report on his or her own activities. A member of a legislative body or the body itself may provide a reference to staff or other resources for factual information, request staff to report back to the body in a subsequent meeting concerning any matter, or take action to direct staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. The key here is that these are limited exceptions and generally discussion or actions not permitted without a proper item agendized. So there are violations for Brown Act violations, and they can involve criminal penalties. A member of a legislative body who attends a meeting where action is taken in violation of the Brown Act, where the member intends to deprive the public of information, which the member knows or has reason to know, the public is entitled to, is guilty of a misdemeanor. Criminal penalties are fairly uncommon. What's more common are civil penalties. And the district attorney or any member of the public can sue to enforce or prevent future violations of the Brown Act. And when such a lawsuit is filed, the district attorney or member of the public may sue to have an action taken in violation of the Brown Act declared null and void. And if the plaintiff prevails, attorney's costs can be awarded. And that's a significant deterrent to violating the Brown Act. Okay, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, John. For those of you who may not be as familiar with Assembly Bill 361, which I know you guys were just talking about earlier, I wanted to provide some facts and publication highlights that we felt were relevant to our work here. Assembly Bill 361 was signed in September 2021, amending the Brown Act to provide additional provisions allowing meetings of legislative bodies to be conducted via teleconference. AB 361 allows a local agency legislative body to hold a meeting utilizing teleconferencing as long as the proclamation of emergency is in effect and in any of the following circumstances: that state or local officials have imposed or recommended measures to promote social distancing, the meeting is being held for the purposes of determining by majority vote whether, as a result of an emergency, meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health and safety of the attendees, or the legislative body has determined that as a result of the emergency, meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health and safety of the attendees. So as a reminder, the governor's proclamation of emergency related to COVID-19 pandemic is still in effect. So I have actually a quick question, Desiree, or anyone from the council, are you guys seeing the next slide, or are you also experiencing the delay?
I'm not experiencing a delay, Nicole.
You're not?
Yeah.
No, okay. Delay.
Okay. No delay.
I just want to make sure, because I want to make sure when I'm talking, you guys are seeing what I'm kind of talking to, the slide.
I had a slight delay, not apparently as much of a delay as John was having.
Okay. Well, thank you. So there are still requirements if meetings are being held via teleconference under AB 361. Let's review some of those. Notice of the meetings must still be given in compliance with the Brown Act, and the notice must include the means by the public, how they may access the meeting and provide public comment. The public must be provided access to the meeting via a call-in option or internet-based service and allowed to address the legislative body directly. The agency does not have to provide an in-person option for the public to attend the meeting. The meeting must be conducted in a manner that protects the statutory and constitutional rights of the parties and public appearing before the legislative body. If there's a disruption to the meeting broadcast or an inability to take the call-in or internet-based public comments, no further action can be taken on the agenda items until that issue is resolved. The body cannot require comments be submitted. They don't have to require that comments be submitted before the start of the meeting. The public must be allowed to make those real-time comments. And then reasonable time for public comment must be provided. If the agency provides a timed public comment period, then the public comment period must be left open until the time expires. All right, so let's jump over to some very important information as well. Committee findings must be made every 30 days to continue to conduct those teleconference meetings under AB 361. The committee must find it has reconsidered the circumstances, as you've done already, of the state of emergency, and that either the emergency continues to impact the ability to meet safely in person, or that state or local officials continue to impose or recommend social distancing. There are, by the way, I really just included the publication highlights, and I wanted to just mention that the entire AB 361 can be found on the state's website, although it sounds like you guys already have it. All right, now we're going to go over the County Executive Office policy, and I'm going to share some details pertaining to the county policy and the bylaws template. In September 2021, the County Executive Office released its Boards, Commissions, Committees, or BCCs, under the jurisdiction of the Board of Supervisors County Policy. The purpose is to establish the policy and procedures for the development, review, and approval of BCC bylaws created by action of the Board of Supervisors, or as required by statute or ordinance, that include the elements contained in the CEO bylaws template, with an overall goal to achieve standardization uniformity, and consistency. The process for our at-large appointments was also established in the CEO policy pursuant to the revised Board of Rules of Procedure Rule 16. Appointments to a BCC that are not designated for nomination by a specific board district are deemed at-large appointments, and the appointments shall be for a period of 2 years. At-large appointments may only be submitted by the board chair for placement on a board meeting agenda. Under this policy, there is a procedure in place that our department will continue to follow to nominate candidates for at-large appointments. And if recommended, if the recommended at-large appointment is approved, then the board's chair's office will submit the ASR and the attachments to the clerk of the board for inclusion on the next board meeting agenda. A lot of information here too. So if you guys need a copy of this policy, feel free to ask and I can send it over to be distributed.
Please just go ahead and do that anyway.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. I believe actually I'll probably send a link to where it's at. It is accessible
to
the public. Okay, great. The County Executive Office BCC bylaws template was revised in July of 2021 and is a part of this policy. BCCs that are subject to board jurisdiction are being asked to work with their county department staff and council to update their bylaws in accordance with the board approved bylaws template. This is something that we're asking you guys work on in the next couple months. Definitely want to try to get that wrapped up though by the end of the year at the latest, but I believe it has to go through a process through your council first. So I've already been sharing this with the county staff as well, so you'll probably be hearing more about that later. OC Community Resources supports several BCCs that are under board's jurisdiction, and the bylaws of each of these BCCs should be reviewed and revised in a manner that are consistent with the new template. However, I like I said earlier, the coordination of that will be through the county staff, and I'll be working through them for that. Bylaws should serve as rules for the internal administration and management of each BCC. So if local, state, or federal authority require additional elements that do not appear in the approved template, or if local, state, or federal authority necessitate the modification of elements that are in the template, then the BCC can deviate from the template. However, if there's more to cover then that's in the template, you know, we can also consider adding to it. So that's why we really want to include our councils in the revision of the bylaws, so we can make sure that we're covering all that's necessary. Okay. Anyway, so we're going to cover some high level bylaws and hand that over to John. And then I think he also has a presentation for you to go into a little bit more depth and detail for your particular bylaws. John, just I have already moved it to the next slide, but whenever you can see it.
Sure, thanks. I couldn't have said it better. These are just some general concepts. Bylaws contain the purpose, duties, rules, organizational structure, and operating procedures for BCCs. The County Board of Supervisors acts as the body in charge of the county's policies and plays a role in appointing members to BCCs, and the BCCs function under the authority of the board. Citizen members on BCCs provide the public with a channel of communication and input to the board and provide an opportunity for citizens to participate in government. Again, these are general concepts that apply equally to OCVAC, but BCCs generally serve as advisory bodies to the board as authorized by the respective bylaws. The bylaws generally describe the procedure by which BCCs advocate, communicate with the public, and work with county staff. BCCs do not engage in political advocacy on their own or on behalf of the county. That's the county's job. BCCs generally do not take positions on pending legislation or legislative issues without the approval of the county. And again, the board directs the county's legislative efforts and has the authority to make policy decisions. We'll talk about this a little bit more in greater detail with respect to your specific bylaws, but the County Executive Office of Legislative Affairs is a lead department for the county's legislative efforts, and county staff from OC Community Resources and County Executive Office of Legislative Affairs can help BCCs ensure that they draft communications and perform their duties in a manner consistent with the respective bylaws and the county's legislative policy platform. While we move to the next slide, I'd really encourage everyone to take advantage of OCCR staff because they can help you navigate the county process and follow the county procedures for making statements, issuing statements, and working with the CEO, Office of Legislative Affairs, in an efficient manner, all of which will help ensure that OCVAC statements are consistent with that legislative affairs policy platform and the county's legislative policy guidelines. So let's pause here. If anyone has questions on what we've just discussed, we could address those now. If you have any sensitive legal questions, we could discuss those after the presentations, and county staff can coordinate a call with me or other members of my office. Okay.
So this is probably more for Nicole, since she went over it, but I'm sure you could answer it as well, John. I just missed a little bit of what she was saying about the procedures for at-large appointments. And I asked mainly because in my new job, I work for a supervisor, and she ought to know what she can and can't do vis-a-vis those. So could you at least give me the highlights, and then I'll look at the document when you send the link.
Okay. I will probably send you over a copy of it because it's kind of a lot, but the highlights are basically that if our county staff actually prepares with you guys the at-large appointment, they collect all those attachments, writes up the supplemental ASR, sends that over to me. I send it over to clerk of the board, CEO for their review, and then send it back to the chair's office, and they're the ones who put it on the agenda if it's approved. It's kind of a long process, and it's way more detailed than that. So I will send you over a copy of it. And also,
ASR.
Well, I know another ASR. And also, something to know is that this is new for everyone. So don't feel like, I don't want you to feel overwhelmed by it, because clerk of the board and I basically walk you through the whole process and hand you what you have to do. So like, it's not a lot for you. It's just a lot for me to remember.
Thanks.
Of course. Thank you for the questions. You never know. Someone else might have that question.
Perfect. Well, Nicole, if you could let me share my screen, that would be great.
John, do you have sharing now? Oh, perfect.
Yes.
Great.
Okay, so we'll just go over the specifics of OCVAC's bylaws. This is similar to last year's presentation. So through the discussion of your bylaws, we'll touch on the legislative affairs policy guidelines for 2022, the County Executive Office Legislative Affairs role, which we've already pretty much discussed, Orange County's legislative platform toward 21 and 22, and the County Code of Ethics that applies to all BCCs, including yours. We can touch on any general questions you may have at the end. So Article 1 of the bylaws cover OCVAC's name and purpose. The purpose is to work in agreement with the county to advise the board on issues that are important to veterans. OCVAC shall operate at no cost to the county. That's provided by resolution. OCVAC shall promote economic and political opportunity for OC veterans, promote the protection of dignity and integrity of OC veterans, keep abreast of legislation that affects veterans' rights, and provide recommendations and input to the board in accordance with the board's revised legislative policy guidelines. Additionally, the OCVAC will promote equal justice before the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the California Department of Veteran Affairs. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the Legislative Affairs Program guidelines and the County Executive Office of Legislative Affairs. Again, the board directs the county's legislative efforts and has the authority to make policy decisions. The board's Legislative Affairs Policy Guidelines for 2022 serve as a protocol for the county, and councils like OCVAC are not to state their position on legislative issues as being a position taken by the county as a whole, unless the majority of the Board of Supervisors has approved it. County Executive Office of Legislative Affairs is lead department for the county's legislative efforts. CEOLA, as it's known sometimes, provides a variety of services that include providing legislative analysis for the board, advice on how to represent the county's interests in Sacramento, preparing a legislative platform for the county, known as the County Legislative Platform, that communicates the county's key legislative priorities and policies and provides a policy direction and guidance for departments and staff, and considering legislative issues and recommendations on legislation and determining whether they are inconsistent with or not included in the county's legislative platform. In the county's legislative platform, we do have certain categories of topics that are covered related to veterans affairs. The county's legislative policy guidelines require that the county's legislative efforts are consistent with the county's positions and coordinated with CEOLA. And they actually state no action may be taken by a department on any legislation which is in conflict with the board policy, legislative affairs program guidelines, and the legislative platform. So that's why it's important to consider what the legislative platform says when you're performing your duties as OCVAC. Want to just maintain consistency there. And of course, respect the county's board of supervisors' role and COLA's role in coordinating all of this. The role of OCVAC is to advise the board. The county advisory board or commission may not make a recommendation or take a position on pending legislation or on legislative issues to any legislative body, either as an organization or on behalf of the county. They may provide relevant information in an advisory role to the board for consideration. So I just want to highlight that second bullet. This is actually revised in the 2022 version. The second sentence was added last year. We went over the 2021 guidelines and it didn't include it. So the guidelines have been revised to be even more clear that BCCs may provide relevant information in an advisory role to the board for consideration. And I think that's capturing the purpose of OCVAC to advise the board and to help the board make its decisions. Departments shall work through COLA regarding all positions on legislation, and departments should route written correspondence on behalf of the county to elected officials at any level through COLA. All right, so we talked about this a little bit, but the legislative priorities of veterans are set out in the county's legislative platform for 21 and 22. They include claims, housing, and services. And the key points are that OCVAC should work with county and COLA to be consistent with the board's policies, legislative affairs program guidelines, and the legislative platform. Article 1C sets out OCVAC. Well, I won't read them to you, but the key points are that OCVAC's functions include learning about problems affecting OC veterans, making recommendations regarding services, and providing information to the community to help. Article 1D covers no discrimination. Obviously, OCVAC shall not discriminate nor employ any discriminatory practice on the basis of any protected group. Applicable local federal laws. Article 2 covers appointment and membership. OCFAC members are appointed by the Board of Supervisors. The bylaws provide for 9 council members to be appointed, 5 of which shall be appointed by the board, with each supervisor nominating 1 council member from inside their district, or each supervisor nominating a person from outside of their district with the ring. As you revise your bylaws, these provisions will likely change. Article 2B2 covers terms of appointments. Generally, the term's 2 years. The terms are staggered to ensure continuity of representation. Members may continue to serve at the end of their term until replaced. And the key points are basically that council members can continue to serve until reappointed or replaced at the discretion of the appointing authority. Article 3 covers duties and authority for OCFAC officers. The bylaws set out the chairperson's duties, the vice chairperson's duties, and the secretary's duties, which are provided by staff from the VSO as non-voting members. Frequently comes up for BCCs is the chairperson is often, as is the case here, authorized to represent the BCC, or in this case, OCFAC, at public functions. And the vice chair will step in and fulfill the duties of the chair in the event the chair is unable to perform those duties. 3B and 3C cover the term for officers and elections. OCFAC officers serve for a term of 1 year, and an ad hoc committee shall be appointed to secure the nominations for OCFAC officers. Additional nominations from the 4 will be accepted by the chair before the vote, and officers will serve until their successors are elected. Article 4 covers elections. Elections are held at the July meeting, and each officer must be elected by an affirmative vote of a majority of the council. Article 6 covers removal and resignation of members. The chairperson may present to OCFAC a recommendation to the board to remove any member based on cause or absenteeism. Generally covers a substantial alteration of the member's qualifications that were originally present when appointed, or something that interferes with the individual's ability to properly function as a member. Removal for absenteeism comes into play when a member is absent for more than 3 consecutive regular or standing committee meetings. And a recommendation for removal requires a majority vote of OCFAC. Members may resign by providing written letter of resignation to the chairperson and to the board. This last bullet's important for county staff. The chairperson shall notify county board of any vacancies within 10 days. The chairperson shall notify the clerk of the board of any vacancies within 10 days. That's to allow the clerk of the board to perform its job. So it's important to keep that detail in mind if anything comes up. Article 7 covers OCFAC committees. As you know, there's an executive committee, 2 standing committees, and ad hoc committees can be formed for those time-limited specific purposes that we talked about in connection with our Brown Act presentation. Committees may use non-OCFAC members to act as consultants to the committees. Article 8 covers meetings and actions. OCFAC shall adopt a schedule of regular meetings. All OCFAC meetings shall be open and public in conformance with the Brown Act, as we previously discussed. And the bylaws repeat the Brown Act's requirements for special meetings and notices. Article 8D covers quorum and voting requirements. The quorum requirements are defined and set out for each of the different types of meetings. The quorum for general meetings is no less than 50% plus 1 of the membership. Executive committee quorum shall be no less than 50% plus 1 of the committee. And quorum shall be the members present plus no less than three for standing and ad hoc committees. Decisions to act made by a majority of the members of OCVAC at any duly constituted meeting shall be the acts of OCVAC, except as otherwise provided in the bylaws. Article 8D3 covers conflicts of interest, political advocacy, and the use of county assets. This is an important article to review. There's a lot of text on this slide. Just go over it. Basically provides that members shall avoid conflicts of interest, avoid and abstain from voting on issues where they might be personally interested. Certainly avoid situations where they have a financial interest. The bylaws provide that no member shall vote nor attempt to influence any other member on a matter under consideration by OCVAC, where the member might be providing services or a situation where they would receive a direct financial benefit or engage in any other activity determined by the county or federal, state, local law, regulations, or ordinances to constitute a conflict of interest. So that's a pretty broad definition of conflict of interest. The chairperson or designee may consult with county staff to assist or make a determination regarding a conflict. Conflicts of interest are really fact specific, and I'd encourage you to work with OCCR staff and county council if anything like this comes up, or if you just have any questions or concerns. I think you want to err on the side of caution for all of this and make sure there aren't any issues. Let's talk about political advocacy. Neither OCVAC nor any of its members shall promote directly or indirectly any political party, political candidate, political activity using the name, emblem, or any other identifier of OCVAC. Additionally, no assets or assistance provided by the county to OCVAC shall be used for sectarian worship. Okay, the Orange County Code of Ethics applies to OCVAC. The Code of Ethics generally requires county officers and employees to adhere to work performance rules and standards for the position, and echoes prohibitions similar to those found in the conflicts provisions in your bylaws at 8D3. Specifically, the Code of Ethics prohibits using public property for personal benefit, engaging in activities that would create a conflict of interest or impair your independence of judgment in the performance of your duties, engaging in prohibited political activity, and meeting and conferring with a former county officer as a, acting as a lobbyist. That probably won't come up for you under OCVAC. Okay, Article 9, public comment. Again, your bylaws echo the Brown Act's requirements for public comment. Public may be, make comments on agenda items at the time the item is discussed by OCVAC. The chairman will invite public comments to be made before OCVAC votes on an item. Public comments on subjects not on the agenda be made at the beginning of the meeting, and the chairperson may establish a reasonable time limit for public comments. Article 10 covers the authority to act, delegated authority. OCVAC generally follows the Robert's Rules of Order unless they are inconsistent with the bylaws or any applicable laws, regulations, or ordinances. OCVAC may delegate authority if circumstances demand action before the next OCVAC meeting, and OCVAC authorizes and grants this authority to a committee to act on its behalf to make specific and limited recommendations to the county with a quorum of OCVAC being present. Another situation where delegation may come up is this third bullet, delegation of authority to executive committee. When unforeseen circumstances demand that action be taken before the next OCVAC meeting, the executive committee is authorized to take action on behalf of OCVAC. But please keep in mind that OCVAC members shall be notified in writing within 72 hours, and such action is subject to review and ratification by OCVAC at the next meeting. There is a limited authority for standing and ad hoc committees. The bylaws seem to provide a little bit of a reminder that committee's authority is limited to those specific functions governed to them by OCVAC. It's to protect against a kind of operational slip, but a committee shall not have independent authority to commit to the OCVAC the architect to any policy or action without prior approval of the full BCC. Article 11 covers adoption and amendment of the bylaws. Members of the executive committee may propose amendments to the bylaws. Amendments shall be submitted in writing to members so they can consider them 5 days prior to consideration. Bylaws may be amended by an affirmative vote, 2/3 of the members present at any regular meeting, providing the amendments have been submitted, and an affirmative vote of at least the majority of those voting, a quorum being present, shall be required to adopt the bylaws. Of course, bylaws only become effective upon approval by the Board of Supervisors. Thank you very much. Thank you for your service to the country and to our county. And I'll open it up to any general questions you may have.
John?
Yes.
I believe you you alluded to the need to periodically update, review and update the bylaws. And I think, as I recall, we have a potential problem with our bylaws. They do not suggest the procedure for handling a tie vote. And you know, right now we have 9 members, so hopefully that won't happen. But you know, when a member isn't present, we can come up with a tie. For instance, in July, that could be an issue around elections. So I was wondering if you had any advice in that regard, or?
Yeah, everyone should make a list, kind of backing up, everyone should make a list of any types, similar types of issues that you think should be addressed in the bylaws revision. As Nicole pointed out, the bylaws need to be revised to conform with the county's new bylaws template, and also to provide for the appointment of at-large members consistent with the new Board of Supervisors rule procedure. So at that time, you could definitely address the number of members voting, who is entitled to vote, the number of members of AUCVAC, any of which we could discuss in further detail after the meeting. But all those options come to mind.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have 2 questions. And by the way, John, we did run into that problem a couple of years ago where we only had 8 members. So the last 2 years, we've had 8 members. And we did run into a tie. We wound up breaking it, but there was no rules or regulations in our policies or procedures or bylaws to deal with it. It happened twice now. And so, and that's not the supervisor's fault because they didn't report a point of that large. But I'm like Stephanie, if that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that sounds okay. Like it's recurring, sure.
Yeah, number 2, you went by, it went off the screen pretty fast here, but I think okay. It was in article number 8. It says something about abstain as a considered a no vote, really?
Yeah, I did go by that. The bylaws provide that abstentions are considered a non-vote.
Oh, a non-vote, not a no vote. Okay, all right, non-vote. There's a difference. There's a difference between a non-vote and a no vote. All right. It went off the screen pretty fast. And then the third, okay, I got it. I'm with you. And then the third thing is we used to have to take every year a code of ethics test. So by what you just said here, we no longer have to take that code of ethics test anymore?
Well, I don't want to say that. I want to check with the OCHR staff that support AUCVAC. It certainly wouldn't hurt, in my opinion. And there's other policies at play here. So let me avoid steering you in the wrong direction. I don't see a specific requirement in your bylaws to take such a test, but it doesn't mean that that requirement doesn't exist.
Well, there was a requirement for a while. I mean, they came in, we had to take a test or we reviewed it. We did, well, we had to take a test. And the last thing, my last question, you mentioned that in order to make a bylaw change, it needed to be in front of the group 5 days before. Usually it was 30 days. So now you can make a bylaw change in less than 30 days?
Well, this shouldn't be any dramatic change because these bylaws were last revised in 2015. And I'm just kind of repeating what the bylaws say, as you know. So if you have a policy or procedure that requires advanced provision of the draft bylaws in writing to each member more than 30 days before it's considered, that is probably what you should keep going with, and you could discuss that.
That's kind of normal. It's kind of normal for someone to put the bylaws forth. It takes 30 days for you to take a look and go through them before you vote on.
Yeah, but what the bylaws say here is just 5 days prior to consideration.
That's why I'm saying that's a big change. That's a big difference. Mm-hmm.
Do you know where the 30-day requirement came from?
It's always been there. That's why I'm asking the question. I saw something that was irregular. That's new.
So technically we can make
a bylaw change. Consider making a bylaw change in the next 5 days and get it on and vote on it at the next meeting.
Yeah. Well, you would need to provide the draft bylaws in writing each member no less than 5 days prior to consideration before
you
reached. Yeah.
Yeah. I get that. I mean, but I'm just telling you, it was just John, forgive me. I'm paying attention.
I know you are.
Okay. Thank you for your time, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity. Anything else, Nicole? Are we concluding? Is Nicole still there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm not sure if I don't have anything else to add, but I'm not sure if.
Erica, any other questions or comments?
No, thank you so much. This is really helpful. You know, we try and do this as part of an annual orientation for all of our boards, councils, and commissions. So we will probably see you again this time next year. But that's good because we have new members and members rotate in and out. So it's a good refresher for those existing members and hopefully those that are new learn something. So thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. If there's nothing further, we'll go ahead and move on to item 7, Veterans Health Administration update. That's Vice Chair Stephanie Wade.
Just going to unmute myself for a second. And this is something that Alexander Gonzalez brought to my attention and that I just did a little checking on, and I'll invite Alex if he's got anything to say on it. But the gist of it is veterans aren't getting a fair shake as far as we can tell from the VA in terms of their ability to access test kits. The problem is the VA has an unclear policy, VA Long Beach, on whether or not veterans can get a test basically on demand at their healthcare provider. And we understand that that's what the average citizen has, the ability to get a free test on demand. And so Alex, for instance, can talk about the difficulty he had in receiving a test when he showed up to the supposedly walk-in clinic. And furthermore, it brought up the question of, are rapid tests available to veterans through the VA healthcare system? And I will have to tell you that I reached out to Director Dannenberg's office at VA Long Beach, the head of the VA Long Beach medical system, which all our county veterans fall under, unless they've elected another provider or another VA provider. And it was pretty disturbing what they said. They basically said, I heard back from a woman named Amy Cantor, and Amy told me that, no, we just don't provide rapid kits. So the only option that veterans have is vis-a-vis, you know, going into a local pharmacy and asking for some of the federal kits that are available to everyone. So I just thought I'd report back on that and also say that I was a little disturbed that I invited them to attend and give this briefing themselves. And I never heard back from Ms. Cantor. So, you know, I will talk to Dwayne and maybe we can figure out if we'd like to reach out again and have a VA, an update from VA healthcare. And I'll just ask if Alex has anything to offer, Alex Gonzalez has anything to offer on his personal experience at VA.
No, thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate you bringing this forward. This sort of was as a result of an anecdotal experience that I had when returning from a trip abroad. It was very challenging to go through the necessary steps to kind of get the clearance I needed to go back to work and everything. And it was just a little puzzling to me that the policy, or rather lack of policy, that the VA has on testing guidelines was just glaringly apparent. So I thought it was something that merited a little further discussion with officials at the hospital, and maybe even beyond. Aside from that, I did, just as a side note, I did through Congressman Lou Correa's office submit a request for information just to better understand the policy and sort of the expectations moving forward. I know that here at the local government level where I work, we're certainly discussing the next steps in terms of COVID and reopening. And we certainly want to be, consistent while staying mindful of any, threats that linger from the virus. So it's a development that will continue to evolve, and I'm sure we'll continue to discuss it.
All right, thank you both for that. Does this, do we need an ad hoc committee to do something with this?
I would like to just suggest, let's try and ask VHA, ask Director Dannenberg's office to attend a meeting. And then let's also make sure that our congressional representatives from the counties, congressional delegation are really invited and encouraged to attend that meeting as well, so they can sort of see, because I think that's a way of putting them on the spot and making sure they're doing right by our veterans. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. I'm just wondering the actual or the proper process for this. We just got our briefing, right? And now we have our OC representatives in the room. Recommendations on how to pursue this?
Is there already a presentation confirmed for March? Do we know? Because whoever has a rapport with them can just invite them as a presenter or a guest, and we can put them on the agenda. But it sounds like they were invited and there was no response. So
why don't I reach out again, and I can reach out directly to Walt as well, and just, see if they're available, and I'll try and get us an answer quickly so that we can plan our agenda if they're unavailable. But I'd really like to see if they can come talk to us about where COVID safety lies. I see Elena's up, and I'm really interested to hear from her as well on this.
Thanks, Stephanie. I just had a clarifying question, so I understood kind of what the original request went out to the VA hospital in Long Beach. Was it was the question, will the hospital be sending free test kits to their enrolled veterans, or is it, and it's a little subtle here what I'm asking, or is it, can veterans request a test? Like, are we asking, are they automatically doing it? Or are we asking, is it just an option?
It's both questions. So, for instance, Alex can speak to it more if I get it wrong, but Alex showed up needing a test, a PCR test, because he had tested positive abroad and he wanted to see if he was still infectious and also needed it in his medical records. He showed up and they tried to talk him out of the test, and they're like, you don't need a test. You're already positive. It's just going to show you're positive. And he's like, no, that's not the point. I need my medical providers to not have to go back to Guatemala to get my records. I want it here. And they were arguing with him. So that seems to us like, in the private insurance field, it's test on demand. And then the second question would be that private insurers are responsible for providing and paying for test kits up to the cost and reimbursing for them up to the cost of $12. Well, the VA has no provision for that. So if you're like, for instance, me, and I'm lucky because through the county, I'm able to get some rapids when I need them, but I don't have insurance other than the VA. I use the VA as my primary medical provider. So there's no provision for me to get that. And what we're saying is that veterans who are supposed to have good quality medical care through the VA don't have the same standard of care that the federal government is mandating exists on the private insurance market. What gives? And so I'd just like to ask them, one is a clarification of policy at that local, you know, at our local VA health department. And the other is clarify for us, at least explain to us, preferably in front of some of our congressional reps, why there's no provision for veterans who get their healthcare through VA to get rapid kits at all.
Got it. Thank you for clarifying, Stephanie.
All right, that makes sense.
And just to reiterate, I mean, we can definitely make room for them on the agenda for your March meeting. Even if we do have a scheduled presentation, we can still put them on the agenda as a guest to provide an update to the council. Time is of the essence, and this is an important issue. So we will make room for March if you can get them confirmed.
I think that makes the most sense, Erica. I think Stephanie and I, we can definitely talk offline and kind of leverage our contacts at the VA and see if they'd be amenable to coming in, providing some public education about sort of what's going to happen next.
All right. Sounds great. Keep me in the loop. That way I can make sure that that stuff's agendized too for March. Awesome. Thank you. We'll go ahead and move on to item 8, Executive Committee Report. I'm going to cede the floor to Stephanie.
I really only have one item, and I know it's been a long meeting, but it's an important one. And I think the best way for me to really convey it in a meaningful way and do it quickly is if I could share screen. I'm going to see if I have the, yep, it looks like I can. And there we go. So I just want to note the passing of the last surviving Pearl Harbor veteran in Orange County. Major John Hughes passed away on January 7th of this year, and it was just 30 days shy of his 100th birthday. And I just, you know, I think it's really important, and I wanted to show the graphic because a couple of the pictures. You can see in the picture on the left, that circled in yellow, that's John Hughes. He was a lifelong California resident who enlisted in the Marine Corps in the 1930s. And on December 7th, he went out to get an early morning paper and saw the first Zeros flying overhead. And then he immediately ran into his barracks and got his fellow Marines to get the only weapons that were at hand, which were bolt action M1s
Springfields. Yeah, 1903s.
Field rifles, 1903s. And that's what you see him doing there. They were shooting at the planes, and he described them at one point when pressed that they were flying so low that he couldn't miss. So, you know, they fought back with whatever they could, which wasn't much. And that, I think, was really emblematic of who the man was. You know, I did a lot of research. There's a slide up that you can see that that my supervisor presented at a board meeting at the end of January to mark his passing. You know, but he went on to have a really exemplary life in a very quiet and understated way. He retired from the Marine Corps in 1964 as a major. Having fought his way, you know, when you see him pictured there, he was an aircraft mechanic, but he had already volunteered for flight school, was trained as a dive bomber pilot, and went on to, you know, fight those Zeros and Kates in a dive bomber and deliver close air support all across the Pacific. Later, he flew transports in the Korean War. Transports during the Chinese Revolution. Very harrowing duty. And then in the Korean War, he had helped develop the first Marine Corps helicopters, the S-52, which was basically like kind of like MASH. They were evacuation helicopters, and described that as some of the best duty he ever had because he knew he was doing good. You know, a series of medals, including the Distinguished Flying Cross and the Air Medal. But then what I also find remarkable is this family man came home, bought a house in Santa Ana, ran a small convenience store for almost the rest of his life, raised 4 kids, decided to go to college and graduated from Cal State Fullerton, a Titan, in 1969, just a year before his two sons. And as I said, led a quiet but exemplary life. And I think it's kind of fitting because I know we had an ad hoc report on how we're going to take care of our 9/11 veterans who are post 9/11 veterans who are a very different cat, because there's a small cohort who bore a lot of the burden. This generation was broad. It was pretty universal service. And I think of them as giants. This man was certainly emblematic of that. And we're losing them. And it's a sad thing that we ought to mark its passing and remember that we have different obligations to, you know, today's current veterans of conflict. Thank you.
Thank you for that. No less important and no less poignant to us also is the loss of one of our commissioner's fathers, Master Sergeant Vernon McDonald. And we wanted to pay homage to his service and him as well. And of course, service through by virtue of Bobby being a member of this august body. He was 97 when he passed. He died on January 13th. Now, for those of you who know Bobby or have known him for any amount of time, you know that he's very active in the Buffalo Soldiers community. And that's primarily because he grew up in a household with a Buffalo Soldier, and he had an uncle and other family members that were Buffalo Soldiers. But his father, who was a Buffalo Soldier, served in the U.S. Army in the European and Pacific theaters, was a member of the All-Negro 1321st, 1321st Engineer General Service Regiment, and assisted General Patton's 3rd Army in his dash for the Rhineland. After his honorable discharge in 1946, he furthered his education to become an electrician. And now this is a fun fact. He was a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. That's a union local for 72 years. And kind of neat to find out that Bobby and I share a connection there. Both of our fathers were members of the IBEW. My dad was a second generation electrician. I'm the 3rd and my son is the 4th. So it's fantastic to see that we've got a connection there as well, not just through service, but in electrical workers. He was married 67 years, and his wife raised their three, he and his wife raised their three grandchildren, or their three children, I'm sorry, in Los Angeles, California. So just fantastic. Sounds like an amazing man. Bobby, you know, if you want to say a few words about your father, you have the floor.
Hey, thank you for bringing it up. I do want you to note that he was, they let individuals go after the Europe War, but they shipped him off to Japan and Korea. And what's poignant about that is both my brother and I and my sister's husband were all stationed. We were all in Okinawa too. So there's a connection with all that. He then hooked up with his group, the 1321st, hooked up with the 24th Infantry, the Buffalo Soldiers there. And he was stationed there and then went on into Korea. I did not share this with you, but I do have a picture of him with the 7 rocks or 8 rocks he was with in Korea from 1945. And it's you could see it. I mean, it's just, I found it a couple of days ago, but it's there. But anyway, he lived a good life. He was a master sergeant. So, you know, I walk my post in military manner, all that other good stuff. But thank you for mentioning this. I appreciate it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Sounds like an amazing man. At this time, we'll go ahead and move on into item number 8, and that is the OCVSO update. Elena Kim.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. We have a couple updates out of the Orange County Veterans Service Office today. The first is the VSO online appointment booking system. So thanks to our OCIT and to Erica, the county has now finalized the contract for the online appointment booking system. So our next steps are for our OCIT business analyst to work on scheduling a meeting between our office and the contracting agency so that we can have discussions and initiate the creation of that system. As an outcome, we hope to get the system up and running to enhance the client experience in scheduling. Our second update is a VSO staff training update. So I'm very happy to announce that 5 of our veterans claims representatives, those are our subject matter experts here in the office on claims issues, have completed their CalVet Training Academy phase two last week. So they're done with phase one and phase two now. And their next steps are going to be coordinating with a CalVet exam proctor who is generously offered to come to Orange County to administer their accreditation exam. And we are aiming to get that scheduled for the month of February, this month. It might get extended into March, but our goal is February. Those are all the updates that I have now. If I left anything out or anyone has questions, please let me know.
All right, we'll move quickly into item 10, CalVet Link update. Is Ben Gale still here?
Mr. Chair, before you get to Ben, I need to take my leave. Fortunately, I am the Black History Month guest speaker at the LA Veterans Advisory Council meeting.
So, nice.
But I get to talk about my aunt, who was the first Black nurse, one of the first Black nurses from the U.S.
I remember Army seeing that story. Yeah.
So they're getting ready to get educated. So forgive me for bailing out on you. But
no worries. Thank you so much for all your service and all you do.
Thanks, Bobby.
All right, Ben, you have the floor.
Great. Yeah, I just want to start by taking a minute to highlight what CalVet's doing right now to make sure that veterans and their families are educated about all the different types of benefits that are out there and our status on that. So our California Transition Assistance Program is continuing to do some in-person, but mostly virtual presentations. I'm pretty much covering about everything you could think of in terms of wanting to educate veterans and their families on benefits. And a lot of these webinars are recorded, pretty easily accessible on our website. Also, always good to remember that this book, the Veteran Resource Book, is still available. It's available as a PDF on our website. You can order a box as well. You know, anyone in the OCVAC here can order a box. You know, these books, we want to get them out there. And I want to jump into talking about a couple of you know, state benefits that connect to the VSO. But just to, you know, as a service provider, one of the complexities of all this is just the wide range of entities that administer all these benefits. You know, you have the VSO administering, you know, three benefits. You have the DMV involved in three benefits. You have the Department of General Services involved in the DVBE administering the DVBE program. You know, you have CalVet administering some benefits. You have the county tax assessor administering. So it really can get tricky, but it just shows why, you know, there's a lot of importance in collaboration and connections. And so just to highlight a couple at the county level, I'm actually just want to highlight what Elena and I were talking about this morning on the phone. You know, we were looking at the property tax exemption for veterans with 100% rating, you know, hoping to increase access. And, you know, you're in the spirit of learning things all the time. I saw something the other day highlighting that unmarried surviving spouses of veterans who are deceased and who passed due to a service-connected condition actually can access that property tax exemption as well. And Elena was able to find some info on that. And so we're going to be, you know, working together and trying to make sure that more information is coming from the assessor's office to make it, you know, clear that that benefit is there. And it's really just it's just an ongoing effort in that spirit of making sure that these benefits are understood. And I guess just one other comment, you know, I think one of the most interesting things happening right now for DVBEs is as part of the recent, most recent federal stimulus package, there's now $1.3 billion that's going to be coming through for California DVBEs. Yeah, that's with a B, right? And so it's a little, I went to an event that all of you know, Bill Cunningham, he's kind of the leading veteran entrepreneur in Orange County, he put together. And it showed me that at least as of a couple of weeks ago, there's really not a lot of clarity yet on exactly how that's going to be rolled out, but certainly something I think very interesting for all of us to keep our eyes on. And I certainly will be. That's it for me.
Thank you, Ben. Item number 11, Kevin Alexander, I don't think he's here. Is there an HCA brief from someone else? All right, we'll go ahead and move on to standing committees. Communications Committee report. Alex Maslin, if you're still here. Yep, he's still here.
Nothing on communications.
Very well. Move on to events and outreach. Vladimir and Mario Munoz.
I have nothing to report.
Very well. Move on to the ad hoc committee. Alex Maslin for the Welcome Home Committee.
Yes. First off, thank you to Stephanie, Alexis, and Alex Gonzalez for all they've done on this. I know we're going a little late, but I just wanted to kind of give a quick summary to remind everyone what we were discussing here. So the Orange County Welcome Home event for post 9/11 veterans is what the ad hoc is working on. And it was conceived at the September OCVAC meeting when we, the council members who were feeling and suffering the or know people who are feeling and suffering the distress that post 9/11 veterans are experiencing due to the withdrawal, chaotic withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan, asked ourselves what we could do to support our 9/11 veterans. And we decided to explore that through our ad hoc. And what we've decided on is an event, something akin to a victory parade or a welcome home event. And we believe that event is necessary due to that chaotic drawdown. And some of the isolation that our service members might be feeling due to that. And we want to publicly celebrate their service. We further believe that such an event could help the sense of well-being of those in the those veterans in our community who feel isolated or forgotten, while also building ties and connections to different veterans groups and services across different generations. The event, as conceived, currently would be an outdoor event held in the fall of 2022. And it would be hosted by the county and led by the County Board of Supervisors, all of whom would be invited to participate. And the county would advertise the event and provide a web portal where post 9/11 veterans and Gold Star families could sign up to participate. Attendees would be welcomed at the event with food and a short pinning service in which community leaders and older veterans would present the 9/11 veterans with a lapel pin that the county would design and a certificate thanking them for their service in the global war on terror. That event, that pinning ceremony is loosely modeled on a Department of Defense program that was funded by Congress in 2012, in which Vietnam veterans were welcomed home in their communities with a lapel pin and a certificate. The program might also include music, food, resource booths from veterans support organizations, color ceremony, and missing warrior table, and possibly a flyover by military aircraft in the missing man formation. There's also been some consideration of including Afghan and Iraqi allies in the activities as a way to honor their service and show the goodwill of American veterans who have been greatly distressed at the plight of our former interpreters and other Iraqis and Afghans that had worked with the US military. Just some quick bullet points to put out for consideration before we open it up for discussion. As far as the possible venues, we believe it should probably be outside just due to the possible number of people participating and also some of the health and safety concerns. Some of the locations that we had talked about were the Tustin Air Base or also the fairgrounds near the Veterans Hall. And then just some kind of broad bullet points for the event itself. Our plan was to suggest having booths or tables with information and resources from different veterans groups and their programs. And then as far as food, possibly food trucks or a restaurant in a perfect world, maybe a veteran-owned business. And then also having music and or a band. And then prior to turning it to more of a social event where the food and music would take place, we would want to have more of a formal ceremony in which we had a presentation of colors and some recognition of our Afghan vets with a proclamation and also talking about the Afghan refugees and the resettlement of them following the U.S. Withdrawal from Afghanistan and also giving our elected officials and other VIPs an opportunity to speak and address the crowd. And then lastly, that possible flyover that I mentioned earlier. Alexis, through her ties, has a possible plan to make that happen. So the next steps would be with direction from the chair and the rest of the council to draft a letter to then be approved by the council and then sent to the Board of Supervisors as a recommendation for their consideration and showing our offer to support and advise them should they choose to host such an event. So with that, the plan would be to try to put together a letter by the next meeting for approval. So before we do that, if anyone wants to add anything to some of those ideas that we had come up with or make any suggestions before we start putting together a formal letter, I will open it up to any comments, concerns, or suggestions.
I'll just comment that it seemed like the plan was pretty comprehensive. So clearly you've done some heavy lifting and determining how you would carry this out. I think it's well formulated and I think it's a great plan. And I think that we should move to support this and drafting a letter and giving that as a recommendation to the supervisors of Orange County.
And just going to second everything that Eric says, is a outstanding plan right here, Alex. I'm excited about the prospects of everything that we can bring to the community with an event like this, and anything that I can do to be part of it, ready.
Awesome. I don't think Dwayne can make a motion, but first I'll say great readout, Alex. I thought that was terrific. And then I'd like to make a motion that we authorize the ad hoc committee to produce that to produce a formal letter that we can present for present and agendize for the next meeting.
A second.
All right. There's a first and a second. So, any more discussion?
Chair Dwayne.
Yes.
Since it wasn't on the agenda. Hi, this is Renee. Hi, everyone. Hope everyone's doing well. But it wasn't on the agenda, and there wasn't given notice to the public that we'd be taking action on an item. So okay. We have to put it on the agenda for the next meeting. Sorry.
Then we'll do that. Yeah. Fantastic. All right. So noted.
And just want a big thanks to everyone on the ad hoc, specifically Stephanie, who was the major contributor to pretty much everything I just said. So credit where credit is due. Thank you.
No.
All good. Team one fight. All right. Is there anything further for that presentation?
Nope, that's all I have. I'll save the rest for next meeting.
All right, fantastic. Move on to item 13, council comments. Any comments from the floor, go ahead and raise your hand if you can. Otherwise, we'll keep it short, sweet. And as we're over on time quite a bit, we'll let folks go. Anybody have any parting comments? Can I mute your mic, raise your hand? All right, thank you everyone for hanging in there with us today. We will see you at next month's meeting on March 9th at noon. Take care, be safe, and stay healthy.